And again, heritability is all about 50% for this trait. And then for average daily gain, the heritability is from 19 to 27%, which is about what we would expect based upon literature. And then for RFI, residual feed intake for these different groups from 21% up to 49, 45%. This is a population of F1 by F1 crosses produced at the US Meat Animal Research Center and fed at the US Animal Research Center. So heritability is looking good. We do find some large effect QTLs, and these are, again, the Manhattan plots that show the SNP effects that are underlying these underlying variation in these traits. And the reason that these look all so compressed and not very much variation down here is that there are a few things, if they're real, have actually quite large effects on the variance. In Angus, we actually have one estimate that there's a QTL that influences dry matter intake and explains 10% of the additive genetic variance. So we're very interested in trying to be able to identify that. But we are...
Those are windows, not stubs.
These are windows, that's right, these are windows. So Dorian does this on 1 megabase windows that have about 20 SNPs in it, so that he can actually, if there's a QTL there, he grabs all of the variation that's in that window.
20 SNPs, okay, but
this
HD, 200
SNPs. 200 SNPs. Yep, and these are all HD data. So one of the things that we've been interested in for quite a long time is do the same genes cause variation in different breeds of cattle? A priori coming into this, I would have expected that that would have generally been true. You know, we have breeds of cattle that are very distinct from each other genetically, but the reality is, from an evolutionary perspective, they've only been separated by perhaps 1,000 years or 2,000 years, not that long. And we would expect that the variation, the things that cause animals to grow differently, to consume feed at different rates, would be common among the breeds. And what we find is that there's some evidence for commonality and a lot of evidence that there is not commonality between the breeds. And so these are the QTLs in Angus, Hereford, Simmental, and then the crossbred animals at the USDA for dry matter intake, mid-test metabolic weight, gain on test, residual feed intake. And these are like the largest 10 that were found in these analyses. And the little boxes represent common QTLs. QTLs that turn up, that create variation in all of these breeds. So there's one at 20 megabases, at about 20 chromosome 20 at about 4 megabases, that's present in these three breeds. This is plague 1, which we've known about actually for some time, and it turns up affecting several of these traits. And this is one at chromosome 7 at 93 megabases on chromosome 7 that turns up in these three breeds. So you get some evidence that there are common QTLs, but over here, dry matter intake, nothing in common between these breeds. And so what we now try to need to figure out is whether or not that represents the fact that there are just completely different genes within these breeds that underlie variation in the traits, and that that has an impact on how we would go about deploying genomic selection. Because when we train in a population of animals, generate these SNP effects, which actually give us our prediction model, we validate those, and then we want to deploy. And the question is, if all of the QTLs are different and the SNP effects differ between breeds, it means that all of these models will end up having to be probably breed-specific. So we will have to develop prediction equations for RFI for all of the major breeds. Last part of this that I wanted to tell you a little bit about is methane and feed efficiency. You may have heard a little bit about this, and if you lived in Europe, you would know a lot about this. So methane production and greenhouse gases have become incredibly important in Europe. And animal agriculture is under a great deal of pressure over there because of the amount of greenhouse gases that are being produced in agricultural production. This is work that Harvey Frickley has led at the USDA, and what he has done is looked at methane production in animals that differ for their RFI. And some of the previous work that's been published suggested that animals that had higher RFI had lower methane production, And that is somewhat contradictory to what Hardy is saying, but it depends upon how you look at it. What he finds is that animals that have lower residual feed intake and therefore are more efficient are actually producing higher levels of methane per unit of feed intake. So part of their efficiency is that they're actually ruminating more efficiently than animals that are more low efficiency. And that results in higher levels of methane production on a per unit of feed intake basis. But now what we need to look at is how much feed did these animals eat in total while they were in the feedlot, and what was the total difference in methane that was produced by those animals. Okay, the last one I'm going to tell you a little bit about is the Heifer Fertility Project. And the Heifer Fertility Project was just funded in January. It's led by Dave Patterson here at the University of Missouri, who's a reproductive biologist. Sparky leads the extension side of this, and she has a team of willing helpers to work on deploying technology that gets produced in this one, in this project. And then my part in this project is actually doing an awful lot of sequencing. And so some of you in the room know a little bit about this. We are probably going to sequence the genome of 200 bulls this year to a depth of coverage of 30x. And the reason we could do that is shown in this graph here. So back when the human genome was published, you know, it cost billions of dollars to actually produce the sequence and generate the sequence assembly for humans. But something really incredible happened in 2006, and that is a new technology, a new sequencing technology, was introduced by a company called Illumina. It was developed by a company called Solexa, and this is on an exponential scale. So Moore's Law tells you how cheap your computer CPU and storage becomes in time. It's exponential. So this is on a log scale here. And what you'll see is that the cost to actually generate a million bases of sequence was in the vicinity of $10,000 about 12 years ago. And today, it's like 5 cents to generate that much sequence. So there's been a phenomenal revolution in the cost of sequencing, which has led to everybody starting to do sequencing. And actually, we started to do sequencing because we worked with dogs as models for neurological disease in humans. And all of these dogs down here have genetic diseases, most of them just single gene defects, but some of them much more complicated. So we're also interested in things like epilepsy, which we know is a complex disease. So we actually started sequencing, and I heard this guy, this is Craig Venter, if you don't know who that is. So Craig Venter is the guy that started the Venter Institute and sequenced the human genome, and you were part of all that at Celera some time ago. I saw him talk at Harvard about 10 years ago, and in his talk he talked about sequencing his dog, which was a poodle. And so I thought, ha, you're nobody in genomics until you sequence your dog. So that's my dog, and I sequenced it. So he's an Italian greyhound, and he actually has a heart murmur. And the reason he has a heart murmur is that if you look at his pedigree, his grandfather is the same individual on both sides of his pedigree. So the breeder thought that inbreeding was a good thing to do, because you're going to fix those good traits in those dogs, right? And as a consequence of that, they fixed 12.5% of this boy's genome, identical by descent, and somewhere in there is a gene that actually causes him to have a heart murmur. And so we're actually working on that to figure out what the mutation is that underlie that. You can do all kinds of cool stuff when you sequence. You can find where there are mutations that actually have big chunks of DNA missing. We've actually found this in a couple of Angus bulls. In fact, a very high marbling Angus bull has about 100 kb on the end of chromosome 1, just completely missing. This dog here has a chunk of DNA missing, and as a function of that, has a disease called Fanconi syndrome. On two copies, that chunk of the DNA is missing. And so what that means is that it's actually a loss of function a little. So when you have a piece of the DNA missing, what it does is it actually either takes the gene, the whole gene out, or it disrupts the gene, it breaks the gene. So the gene no longer works. So we actually noticed this when we were actually sequencing a lot of these dogs, that we were seeing a whole bunch of these loss of function alleles in there. And we thought, man, how can you have so many genes in the genome that are floating around that are broken? So we started looking at some data that we generated, and at that time, we'd sequenced the genome of these 11 bulls to 30x coverage. We're actually, right now, today, I think we have 48 bulls now sequenced. We have Herbert's lined up to go, we have Beefmasters lined up to go, and we have a few other breed associations that I'll tell you about in a minute, lined up to go. And we developed, it took us about 2 years to actually build the analytical pipeline to handle these data. So you've got to be thinking about, most of you have laptops, and in your laptops you have hard drives, and that hard drive probably is something less than a terabyte. And every time you sequence the genome of an animal to about 30x of coverage, you get enough sequence data that you fill up just about that hard drive. So if you start thinking about sequencing 200 bulls and 80 dogs, which is what we're doing, you generate enormous amounts of data. You can't look at it. You can't even move it around very quickly. And it took us about 2 years to build the pipeline that we push it through, and this kind of describes that. But interestingly, when we did that, in the first 11 bulls, we found 2,463 genes in Angus that were broken. So at least one of these bulls had one copy of the gene that was broken. We thought that was pretty remarkable. Until, and this just sort of shows where they are and whether they're annotated or not, and the number of mutations within each of those genes. But of those, we actually find some of them that are homozygous. So there's some bulls that are homozygous for these loss of function alleles. Well, that means that they're not genetic defects. Otherwise, these bulls wouldn't be registered in the Angus breed. And it means that they're not lethal, because if they were lethal, the bull would be dead. He wouldn't even be here. So it's kind of remarkable that there's this big penalty that bulls carry by having these loss of function alleles in there. And I actually think that this is probably what's responsible for heterosis when we actually make crosses between two different breeds. That the genes that have loss of function of genes that are in Angus are different, or at least a number of them, a proportion of them, are different to what we see in other breeds like Simmental and Hereford. And so when you make crosses between those two different breeds, you get rid of these homozygous loss of function alleles, and you recover functionality of those genes, and you get increased performance with that. So what we're interested in is looking at these ones that never turn up in homozygous form. And it turns out that if you actually look at the data that are now coming out of human, what we see in these bulls is about the same as that you see in the human population. So if you look at these classes right here, there's about 500 or 600 of them that are in each animal. So each animal is carrying about 500 of these loss of function alleles, and in the human 1,000 genome project, they find very similar numbers. So it's not as though this is unusual, but the question is, do any of these impact, in this case, fertility? And to actually look at that, we went to the mouse knockout database. So there's actually been a study in mice that's run for about 10 years where they have tried to knock out every gene in the genome. So 20,000 genes, knock them out one at a time in mice and actually record what it does in those animals. And in that database, there are about 2,600 genes that are known that if you knock them out in mice, you just physically break the chromosome, pull it out, breed those mice till you get two copies, that about 2,700 of them end up being lethals, early developmental lethals. And we took the ones that we found in this Angus population, and we said, if we look at those in mice, how many of them are lethals? 176 are lethals. So we found 176 genes that look like they're floating around in Angus as loss-of-function alleles, and based upon what we know about mice, living mice, when they get together as two copies, you get a failed pregnancy. The embryo just doesn't make it. So that's what this project is all about. This project is all about trying to identify how many of those are in the population. And so we budgeted to actually sequence a total of 100 Angus bulls, 89 in the grant, and the 11 that we'd already done. But then we wanted to bring in as many breed associations as were interested in this project. And so we went to the breed associations and said, we'll use this money to leverage sequencing of animals from your individual breeds. And so American Angus has contributed funding. Herford's contributed funding. Beefmaster, Gelvie, Charolais are on board. Simmental are on board. Meinanjou are on board. Haven't heard anything from Wagyu. Australian Angus is on board, Argentinian Angus is on board, New Zealand Angus are on board. Between them, they've contributed over $200,000 towards sequencing. We have $500,000 in the grant for sequencing. Sequencing costs are coming down, and we will do from 10 to 15 animals from each of these breeds. More in Angus we have to, because that's what the grant was about. We said that we were going to do that. That'll be done by the end of the year. We'll have all of those genomes sequenced and analyzed by the end of the year. We're exchanging sequence data with people that are also generating sequence data. I know Clay Center is sequencing a lot of bulls. There's a big Canadian genome project to sequence bulls. And in fact, we said, let us run the Angus, you run other breeds, we'll swap the sequence data. So, what happens when we get all of this sequence data and analyze? Well, what will happen is we're going to build a SNP chip. So everything that we find in the analysis of those sequencing data that looks as though it's a loss of function allele, we'll build onto an assay. And right now, the lead in this is Affymetrix. They can put about 53,000 mutations into an assay. So we'll put 10,000 SNPs that are off the 50K or 70K assay to use for imputation, and then we'll fill the rest up, the other 45,000 SNPs, with mutations that we find in the sequencing project. And then what we're going to do is genotype 10,000 heifers, and we're going to ask this question. When we genotype those 10,000 heifers, and we look to see whether they get two of these together as homozygous form, it means it's not lethal. If they never show up in homozygous form, it means they're lethals, they're impacting fertility, and we need to select against them. I'm hoping by the time we get to this point that we'll be able to do more than 53,000 SNPs, and I hope that we're going to be able to genotype more than 10,000 animals. Because what we also want to do with the breeders that are collaborating with us on this is actually return to them MBVs on those heifers for things like feed efficiency, growth, carcass data, so that they can use that information in selecting replacement heifers. So, updates on this are that we are in the process of getting the sequencing done. We're about a third of the way. Turns out we had to buy a new sequencer, so we just spent $500,000 at the University of Missouri to get a new sequencer. We had to spend another $100,000 to get the computers we needed to analyze these data. And Alison Van Ingham is working with Brian Kinghorn in Australia to develop software that will allow breeders to actually compute selection indices, but also make mate selection decisions. So if you genotype a bull, and you genotype a heifer, and you know which of these lethals are in the genomes of each of those animals, you can make mating decisions to avoid putting those lethals together as homozygous form and avoid losing embryos. And hopefully that's going to have a significant impact on fertility within the breed. So that's all I have for you today. Additive genetics, this is how it works. Thanks a lot for your attention. Appreciate it.